Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. I'd like to thank you for supporting your local independent booksellers. Tonight, I am pleased to introduce Carl Alexander as he presents and signs his latest work, Jacqueline the Ripper. This book is the sequel to Carl's 1979 bestseller, Time After Time, in which H.G. Wells not only writes about a time machine, but actually builds one. Wells is friends with a professor who turns out to be Jack the Ripper, and who steals the time machine and journeys to 1979. Outraged, Wells follows, chases the Ripper through San Francisco, determined to bring him back to Victorian England to serve justice. Along the way, he meets Jane, a modern American woman, and they become time-crossed lovers. In a showdown with the Ripper, Wells uses his scientific genius to send the killer to infinity without the machine, leaving him stranded outside of time. Then Wells and Jane journey back to Victorian England and are married, convinced they'll live happily ever after. Jacqueline the Ripper picks up the story years later with a homesick Jane visiting Los Angeles 2010. Inadvertently, this trip frees the Ripper from his prison out of time, twisting his fate and transforming Jack into Jacqueline. Wells follows Jane and must learn to deal with 21st century America while also trying to save Jane from the Ripper bent on vengeance. Please join me in a warm welcome for Carl Alexander.
Thank you, Chuck. I don't have anything left to say. Actually, I'm very pleased to be in Denver. My daughter lives here, and my grandchildren live here. And, in fact, my daughter went to DU, but she wasn't always that way. In fact, when she's a true L.A. girl, and when she was flying back here to go to school for the first time, she looked down at the Rockies and said, "What's with all the concrete on the mountains?" He just read the first part to refresh your memory of what happens with before this book starts. In 1893, then 2 years later, they were married, convinced, this is H.G. and Amy, convinced that they would live happily ever after. 13 years passed, and in another universe. Well, 13 years later, Amy has left H.G. because of an unhappy marriage. But she doesn't leave by hansom cab or train. She steals his time machine. The story begins at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. How many of you ever seen the Getty Museum? Just one? Okay. For those of you who haven't, I urge you to go because it's one of the few good reasons to visit Los Angeles. And I'd like to give you H.G.'s take on the Getty Museum. And then Jacqueline's. He glanced warily behind him, then descended the stairs to a lawn, took a path through trees to a giant circular garden that resembled an amphitheater featuring concentric circles of flowers in its center. He wondered if he were in some symmetrical Stonehenge, was soon lost on another path through exotic bushes, flowers, and trees, bridges over brooks that played melodies with water, and nothing was sharp or angular. Like the stone and glass creation behind him, the garden was an homage to the curve, and he continued on, filled with joy to find himself amid such futuristic beauty and solitude. It settled over his ragged psyche and soothed him, and despite the absence of Amy, his spirit soared. no Philistines, no 21st century techno-wizards of war and alienation could have created this remarkable environment. Only enlightened artists and architects have held sway here. New men, citizens of the world, who have discovered a way to harness the technology that mocked and almost killed yours truly 31 years ago. How marvelous, an enormous, sprawling museum that stands as a shrine to the possibilities of the human condition. Jacqueline has another take. She gazed in awe at the lights of the museum's perimeter, the warm glow from within. The complex struck her as a glorious castle of the future, awash and heady with the good works of man ripe for ruin. In what year will the barbarians come, their fathers and mother whores propagating right now on the mean streets of this very same city? In what year will the barbarians blow up the place and burn the art, murder the patrons, and rape the docents? When will they pillage? It is only a matter of time, for this museum is but a self-righteous mockery of the truth, a turning of the cheek to the real nature of the human beast. That's pretty much one of the important themes of the book, is the duality of these two viewpoints between HD's desire and firm conviction that it will be a utopia versus the dystopian view. I mention the Getty because we are very happy to be at the tattered cover. I suggested to my editor that we launch the book at the Getty Museum, and he said, that's really a cool idea, let's do it. So we contacted the Getty, and they said, great, sure, let's do it right here. $20,000 for 2 hours on the courtyard. You have to provide security, and the public is not allowed. We are very happy to be at the tattered cover. The other theme that this book deals with that I think is pretty interesting and that took me a long time to get right, if one can ever get it right, is what happens to a legendary psychopath trapped in a beautiful woman's body, and how does that psychopath change? I'll leave you to read the book and discover for yourself, but it brings up the nature of not the battle of the sexes so much as the complex nature of women, as opposed to, in my opinion, a more simplistic man or male of the species. Because when you add those emotions to Jack the Ripper, it changes him profoundly and makes him question what he does. Not that he doesn't do it, but it makes him question it, and I think it's fun to read. I have one other passage I'd like to read for you in here. This is when H.G. is trying to find Amy, and he's gone to their original house that he has bought, and his time machine is there in the basement. Oh, yes, the one thing that I forgot is the reason the time machine is on the Getty in 2010 is because that's where it is on the world tour of the exhibition of H.G. Wells, A Man Before His Time. It's a featured relic, you might say. He eased back out of the engine compartment. Despite his stubborn conviction that someday a world state would reign supreme, he wasn't anxious to time travel again. It wasn't merely the journey itself, a headlong rush that reduced one to quantum foam. Rather, it was a fear of a reformulation error, that he wouldn't be reconstituted correctly at the destination hour. And even if the trip went smoothly, what would 2010 be like? 1979 had been a dismal potpourri of hurried, alienated men creating more and more advanced technology as if they themselves were machines. Ironically, those men depended on that very same technology so that one wasn't certain who was serving whom. Since coming home, he had lived with new hope and idealism of the Edwardian age and had regained confidence in science and technology and the inherent goodness of man. Still, it was one thing to write speculative essays and books and quite another to go witness the reality. conceivably by 2010, some genius would have synthesized a collective mind, or the United Nations he so eagerly read about in 1979 would have moved closer to his dream of a world state and a lasting peace for all mankind, and he would prove himself wrong about the egocentric mankind with a sinister technology. Will you quit your infernal procrastination? For better or worse, Amy is the love of your life. He took the bicycle lock off the workbench, though he didn't need it. He'd bring Amy back before they left, and the lock would still be on the central gearing wheel, keeping the utopia safe from the tomb robbers of the future, for lack of a better term. However, if the utopia was on a world tour in 2010, and he forgot to lock the central gearing wheel while searching for Amy, there was a slim chance some errant child could slip past the barriers and accidentally propel himself through time. But that was a risk he would take. If Malthusian predictions held true in the 21st century and the world had a serious population problem, the loss of a thoughtless child was not necessarily a bad thing. Coming back through time, however, the utopia rejuvenated itself, a phenomenon that still baffled him. No matter. As a motor car mechanic might say, the old girl still had some years left on her. He glanced down, chuckled with surprise. Silly girl. Amy had left her purse by the cabin chair. He swung inside and settled himself in the chair. It wasn't as big as he remembered it. He smiled ruefully. The chair is exactly the same size as it was 13 years ago. It's the pilot backside that has gotten larger. Sheepishly read the destination indicator. Year 2010, month June, day 20, time 12:01 a.m. Usually, Amy was in bed long before midnight, so he had no clue what had possessed her to go to that wee hour. Maybe fear. Theoretically, he would arrive with assurances while she was still in the vicinity, wondering what in the world she had done. Yet he made no move. Though he was not to trust intuition, he felt that something was seriously wrong, and he looked for a sign. He gasped. Blood was on the floor. Barely discernible in the dim light, it looked like a trail of shiny black paint. Amy, my God, what have you done to yourself? Hurriedly, he pulled the medical kit from the chair. Other than himself, Amy was the only one who knew it was there. And yes, she had opened it. The blood must be hers. A sterile bandage and roll of gauze were gone. The tincture of iodine had been opened. She had probably cut herself in a rush to get out of the machine. Muttering, he cleaned up the blood with a piece of gauze, then realized he was procrastinating again. Good Lord, man, go get her. He strapped himself in the chair, turned the key, and engaged the switches, listened gloomily to the engine's characteristic hum as it warmed, familiar like a Mozart melody once heard, never forgotten. He shoved the accelerator hem lever forward until it locked in the flank position. As the engine whined and the machine began spinning, he suddenly recalled why he had put the lock on the central gearing wheel in the first place. It was so that man could not play God, as he had done in 1979. Yet here he was on his way again, his beloved wife already a casualty of an unfamiliar future. A crystalline flash. He felt himself melting, merging with the flux, lifted out of 1906 and sent rocketing along the fourth dimension. He realized a split second too late why man, at least this one, shouldn't play at the supernatural. He didn't believe in God. Okay. This is in my own mind, so I won't. I will presume. You're probably wondering how Jack the Ripper gets released from Infinity and turns into a woman, and I'm going to have to say the details are in the book. Any questions? Yeah.
I was curious about the 30-year time span between the first one and the second one. I mean, had you planned on doing the second one?
I was going to talk about that. Obviously, I am now. I was prevented from writing a sequel for 5 years by the contract I signed with Warner Brothers for the film version of Time After Time. And then I was involved in other stuff. And then when I thought seriously about it, I didn't want to write a sequel. I wanted to write something where the concept topped the concept for the first book. And I think this one does. But I didn't think of that right away. In fact, I didn't think of that until the year 2000. And I was having lunch with a friend of mine, and this is like after maybe, I don't know, dozens of people have said, hey, you ever going to do a sequel to Time After Time? And I said, maybe I will and maybe I won't. I don't know. And he said, we were both kicking it around, and we said at the same time, well, geez, what if Jack the Ripper somehow turned out to be a woman? Well, I started working on it the next day. And tried to match the difference in real time with the time that is in the book. It's not very confusing. It's not a high-tech, hardware, sci-fi book. It's, trust me, if I can understand it, you can understand it. Another question. Yes.
Do we need to read the first book first?
Absolutely not. What Chuck read in the beginning, the before section, brings you up to speed with respect to this book, too. However, the original book, is going to be reprinted in February, but it's really a new book because my editor asked me in the middle of the summer, he said, hey, we're going to bring Time After Time out again. Do you want to make any changes? Which is very unusual for an editor to say that. And I said, sure, because it was my first book and there were a lot of things that I was unhappy with after looking at it after a period of time. And I suppose that means that I've changed as a writer. Hopefully it means I've gotten better, but the new edition of Time After Time is not the same as the old one. Same characters, same structure, same concept, much better written. Questions? Yeah.
What fascinating things did you find about H.G. Wells in your research, other than he was a womanizer and wouldn't have made a good husband?
One of the things, or several of the things that I both fascinate me and I admire about H.G. Wells is that his predictions of the future were so accurate. He predicted World War I. He predicted air forces and war in the air. He, in a casual conversation to the, I think it was the Minister of Defense of Britain at that time, mentioned the possibility of an ironclad tank. And a few years later, the British Army, the Royal Army, had tanks. He predicted the nuclear weapons. In fact, ironically, the first nuclear weapon was dropped the year that he died. But he wasn't just into... He was concerned about mankind and technology destroying the human condition, but he also had a great sense of humor, and he invented things like, or wrote about things like air conditioning, vacuum cleaners, self-making beds. He was a amateur cartoonist, and he did and his family would do cartoons, what they called pitches, and they would give, you know, on the state of their marriage and their domesticity and pass among themselves with the kids and with his wife Amy, who insisted upon being called Jane. The other thing, what I admire about H.G. Wells is he was true to his convictions. He was a socialist. He believed in free love, obviously. He advocated things like daycare centers long before their time. And these kinds of things enraged the feminists of the time. which he could never understand because their goals were the same as his. Plus the fact that, in my opinion, not only was he a great thinker, but he was a great writer. If you find his novels, his social realism, for example, as being too dated, I recommend you pick up his experiment and autobiography. I think I've read it 3 or 4 times, and every time I read it, I find something new and pleasurable about it. Any other questions? Yes.
So then when you were writing the books, were you interested more in Wells, or were you interested in Jack the Ripper as a character,
really? I was interested in both, but Wells is more work, because if you're going to write fiction or something that takes off or is a what-if premise that is not realistic, by its very nature, you have to make it as realistic as possible. Therefore, I wanted to be true to H.G. Wells in every respect, not just what he did, but what he was thinking. In fact, if you've ever seen the movie Time After Time, there's one thing, that still sticks in my mind and annoys me, is that he meets Amy in San Francisco, and they get along and obviously fall head over heels for each other, and they make love, and after they finish, H.G. rolls over and lights a cigarette. He hated smoking. He absolutely detested cigarettes, and that has bothered me to this day still. But it's details like that, I think, that you have to be careful with, especially if you're dealing with a situation that is not flat out naturalistic. On the other hand, Jacqueline was fascinating to write in a different way. And what I mean by that is nobody really, despite the books, nobody really knows that much about Jack the Ripper. All they know is that he is synonymous with evil and serial killing and stuff like that. Even Patricia Cornwell's book doesn't give you much of an insight into what his character was like. But it was still just as difficult for me to write about he/she, because you have to think of a character that has conflicts, and obviously you can't make her too sympathetic, but it has to be complex, if that makes any sense. Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.